Hello, I'm Eddie Merckx. Welcome to the VeloCast.
And welcome to another edition of the VeloCast. My name is Scott.
And I'm John.
Well, coming up on this week's show, we try and make sense of the huge amount of bike goodness coming from Eurobike. We have an interview with the legendary Joe Murray and the sad passing of Laurent Fignon. And amongst all that, we have O'Grady and Schleck going out on the Raz. But first, apparently there's been some minor bike race going on in Spain over the past week or so, and since we here at VeloCast Towers are keen to support these small and upcoming races, we thought it best to see what's been going on at something called the Vuelta.
Not much, actually. It's been dull as dishwater.
Moving on then. Now I'll fess up and say that I wasn't here and was off in Germany covering Eurobike, so I haven't seen hide nor hair of the Vuelta this year, and judging by what I've been able to follow on various websites and Twitter, that's actually been a good thing.
No, I reckon there's been about 10 minutes of interest in riding in the first 10 stages.
Oh my.
I mean, I don't know if I'm just burnt out because the Giro and the Tour were so good, you know, and they were extravagantly good this year. Both of them were Grand Tours, which were amongst the best I've seen. But I'm really struggling with this one. I mean, I've been religiously turning it on every day and sitting down because I knew we'd have to talk about it. And I've religiously been going away and doing the ironing and, you know, taking up knitting and, you know, whatever I can do to get away from watching it. It's not been great. But, you know, it's only stage 10, so there's time for it to blow apart and the excitement to start, so we can keep our fingers crossed.
That's true. I mean, is there anything specifically from the first, you know, 9 or 10 stages that you want to talk about? I mean, there's obviously been some developments outside of the race itself, but sticking to the racing itself for a second, is there anything that you're needing to cover?
Well, the bits that have interested me were a couple of really quite dramatic misfires by Cav. I mean, he mistimed a couple of sprints that I would have sworn were his, you know, while they were being set up. The prologue, which was in the dark, I think was a disaster. I mean, we got some good photos, but the riders were clearly taking it easy because they were scared of the dark roads, you know, as well they should be. Who knows who's lurking in the shadows? Moncoutier's got some form, you know, in the hills he's shown himself. Pataki's won a stage but has gone home because I think, you know, the drugs thing that's been looming over his head's coming to a head. And all still to play for. I mean, after 10 days, the gaps at the top are absolutely tiny when you consider it's one of the three great Grand Tours. So I'm struggling to find anything interesting to say about the first 10 days other than that in the actual racing. Although, as you say, there's been some stuff on the fringes of the race that's been both tragic and worthy of comment.
Yeah, but we'll come to those in a second. I mean, you mentioned the prologue in the dark, which was one of the things that we were most looking forward to when the route was announced. And I think I said to you just before we started recording that it seems to be the way that as soon as anyone tries to make a stage or a race different or more interesting, and I can understand the riders thinking behind this, as you say, who knows what's lurking around the corner when you're riding in the dark, but there seems to be this kind of feeling of actually we'll just get through this, and and the differences and the developments that people are trying to bring into any particular stage just seem to get overlooked.
Exactly that. And I mean, I think we're getting towards the end of a long season as well. People are tired, and what they want is just what they know. You know, introduce some innovation at this time of the year. Nobody's got the energy for it. And they seem actually to be a bit Luddite. For people who ride in some of the highest tech equipment in the world, riders do seem to fear change. I mean, we saw that in the stages where they took away the radios in the Tour last year. But this, it made for some fantastic still photography. I mean, Graham Watson had some stunning shots out of this prologue. But for racing, it fired a blank.
Yes, well, quietly so. Now, one of the major and tragic talking points of this year's Vuelta was the news that Team Sky Swanier Chema Gonzalez died in Seville 5 days after he was taken to hospital with a virus that developed into sepsis blood infection.
tragic. I mean, the Sky, we talked about how they'd done well in their first year, but this entire welter must be, you know, their worst nightmare come true. The team have been ill, and for a while there was some, you know, rampant speculation that Sema had the same infection that, you know, the riders had to drop out of the race with. But in fact, it was a completely different thing. Sadly, it took his life, and I don't think I've ever seen such a universal approval of somebody from the peloton. I mean, David Miller, for all that we've given him a hard time, and, you know, Simon Lam hates him with a passion, wrote a really passionate obituary. And across the board, he seems to have been liked. Young guy, committed to cycling with a family. It's tragic he lost his life, and I think we should salute Team Sky for having the courage in these days of commercial pressure to say, actually, no, we can't race with him going, we're out.
Yeah, Team Principal Dave Brailsford said, "We are devastated to report that Chema tragically passed away on Friday evening in hospital in Seville. His close family were with him. Chema will be remembered as a warm-hearted colleague who was a joy to work with and was universally respected by our team and throughout the pro cycling scene. Our thoughts are with, of course, his family and friends." And that was echoed by the Vuelta General Director, who said on Spanish television that it's a real blow. We knew that he was in a critical condition, but we didn't imagine it would come to this.
Yeah, I mean, rest in peace, mate.
Now, from the sad and tragic to the arguably ridiculous, where it was announced yesterday that Bjarne Riis had removed Andy Schleck and Stuart O'Grady from the Vuelta after the pair contravened team rules by drinking alcohol after dinner.
Quite right. Give them their cases, send them home. No argument.
Well, Andy Schleck released a statement on his way home that said, "I acknowledge that I have broken a rule on the team by going out for a drink after dinner, and for that reason, Bjarne has decided to send myself and Stuart O'Grady home. I'm responsible for my actions, and even though I think it's too harsh a decision, I respect that Bjarne is the boss and he needs to do what he thinks is best. I was getting back into shape and would really have liked to stay at the Vuelta and help Frank and the rest of Team Saxo Bank."
I think Riis did what he had to do. I mean, he's got a whole slew of new riders coming in next year, coming along with Bert. There's been a lot of uproar in the team, where you've got Cancellara talking openly about leaving, even though he's got a year of his contract left. You've got Andy, you know, they know he's going, they know Frank's going, and they went for a beer. Now, these guys are highly paid professionals, and I mean, there's talk in the press of them being out till 5 o'clock at a disco and all sorts of nonsense. Stu O'Grady said, "We just had a couple of beers, but it doesn't matter if they just had one. They broke the rules. They're paid highly to obey the rules." And, you know, Riis did what he had to do. He drew a line in the sand and said, "Doesn't matter who you are. Doesn't matter if you're one of the most talented riders of your generation and one of the most valuable assets I've had in Saxo Bank. You break the rules, you go." And you know that certain little Spanish folk are going to be thinking, "He takes it seriously. I'd better behave next year."
Well, you mentioned Stuart O'Grady there. He expressed disappointment at the pair's ignominious exit, saying that Riis has overreacted. He said, "We stepped out of the team hotel at 10 p.m. and stopped for a couple of beers at a bar in the local piazza. We had two beers, that's all. Some members of the European press over here have made us sound like we were on the drink all night. That's simply not true." And he says that, you know, he doesn't want to sound like he's whinging, but the decision to pull us out of the race was harsh. "The decision has cost me 2 weeks of hard racing preparing for the Worlds in Geelong. It also means I've ridden my last race for Saxo Bank. This is not the way I would have wanted to end my career racing for Bjarne Riis. I've ridden my guts out on the front of the team for the last 6 seasons. Not a happy man."
I love Stu O'Grady. He's one of my favourite riders. You know, gutsy. Even when he's got umpteen broken bones, he tries to race. He's right, you know, he's going to miss 2 years, a crucial preparation for a World Championships on his home soil. Maybe he should have thought about that before he got the beer out.
Yeah, I mean, if it's as cut and dried as, look, whilst racing, you do not go to a bar in a local piazza for a couple of beers. End of story.
The other thing that I think is more telling, and it's borne by Andy Schleck's form, I think it was Sorensen who said that he's done nothing since the tour. You know, if he'd been serious about supporting his brother Frank, he would have been training his wee, you know, petite derriere off between the, you know, between the two of the Vuelta. And he just hadn't. I mean, his form's shown that he hasn't. He can say what he likes. So, It does seem harsh, and there are going to be people who will construe it as sour grapes because they're leaving the team. But Reece did what he had to do. You know, as I say, the team's been a bit unruly lately, and what he's done here, you know, he's taken the velvet glove off the iron fist and said, "It's my team, you do what I tell you."
Yes, well, you mentioned a certain little Spanish person coming to work for Bjarne Riis next year. And Alberto Contador, the three-time Tour de France winner, has confirmed that he will ride both the Tour de France and the Vuelta next year. Well, almost confirmed, saying that if everything goes right, I'll do the Tour and the Vuelta.
And I think he'll probably win both of them. I think, you know, the three in a row is pie in the sky now, unless there's a perfect storm. But, you know, In the Tour, we've seen he's the best Grand Tour rider of his generation. And in the Vuelta, let's face it, half of the teams are going to ride for him anyway. So, I mean, his competitions...
Don't mention Robert Miller.
No, absolutely don't, mate. Although we will in a minute, but don't mention him in this context. You know, he's the darling of the Spaniards. He's got that in his pocket. If he carries even two-thirds of his form forward from the Tour, so... I think we'll see a double Grand Tour winner next year.
Well, that is the thing. I mean, you said there about two-thirds of his form. We did see a Contador this year that wasn't infallible.
Let's not beat about the bush. We think he was slightly more, or I think, let's just put it that way, he was slightly more fallible because his preparation
was... He was slightly less prepared.
Exactly.
Wink, wink.
Now, these guys aren't stupid. Whether they're on the hot sauce or not, and I mean, who's to say whether he was? But whether they're on the hot sauce or not, they have top-ranked sports scientists behind them. They'll have been analysing all the data, every bit of data that came out of Contador this year, and they'll have learned how he prepares when the playing field's level in a slightly different place, let's say. And they'll put that into action next year. We will see a sublime Contador next year, because they'll have learned a lot this year, and they'll apply that to his preparation and training. It'll be a different race next year, mark my words.
Okay, well, things had been looking good for Taylor Finney in the Tour de l'Avenir when the American took victory at the prologue in Vierzon. However, things didn't go quite to plan, as a major crash on Tuesday saw him lose over 19 minutes as Anthony de la Place took the stage.
Now, we were talking about this before the show, and you said we should cover it next week in detail. And you're quite right, and we'll save the majority of it for next week, because, you know, it's not one of the big races. It's a race that we all know because it gets a lot of coverage because it's up-and-coming young riders. But there were a couple of points I wanted to mention from this race. And the first that was in a prologue on a hillier course than the Tour prologue. And it's difficult to compare light from light, but we can get a general idea class. Taylor Finney turned in an average speed that would have got him third in the Tour prologue. He seems to be someone with a very high regard for his own talents and not afraid to speak out when perhaps it would be wiser not to.
That was very diplomatic there. Well saved.
He's clearly a huge talent. Crashed out and lost 19 minutes, so, you know, he's gone now. And he's talking about withdrawing because he wants to save himself for the Worlds. So we'll see today whether he starts or not. But a prologue at that age, at that speed, on that kind of course... He's a force for the... I mean, this has got to be a future Grand Tour winner we're watching here. So that's worthy of mention. The other thing that's worthy of mention is that having been a shoe-in under, you know, for Radio Shack for probably since he was in nappies, you know, he's now being courted by quite a few teams, and there's quite strong talk of him going to BMC. There was talk of Garmin having him. So Radio Shack seems to be putting the back burner, and he's talking about it's because he wants continuity in his career, and he's not sure once Lance goes whether Brunel will carry on. But a lot of people are saying, you know, rat sinking ship.
So, well, that's a major talking point then, if that is the case, that even there's the notion that, you know, within the team and in the mindset of the younger riders, nobody quite knows what's going to happen once Lance goes and if Brunel's going to stay. I mean, that's that kind of rampant speculation. People like you, I, the media in general, and all the fans can speculate about. But you would think that within the team itself, there would be, listen, keep this under your hat, but here's exactly what's going to happen. Here's how your careers are stable. Here's how this team is going to be stable. Here's the plan. I mean, if nothing else, that's what Brunel has always been good at, as a plan, and you would think that there would be some manner of kind of graceful handover to whoever's going to follow him, if indeed he is going to go when Lance goes.
Well, I think he's been the anointed for as long as I can remember. You know, they've been hip to hip, but I think that whole kind of Radio Shack thing might have their eyes on some other stuff. Mm-hmm. Don't know. Could be. The other thing is that the lead's been taken over by Alex Dowsett, a British rider, who is going from strength to strength. I mean, he's another one who, a year ago, folk in Britain would have heard of him. He's going to be a world force. So that the Tour de l'Avenir is actually living up to its name here. It's showing us riders who, in 5 years, we're going to be cheering as giants of the road. So we'll do it in more detail next week. But Finney's riding the prologue, and the BMC rumours, I think, were worthy of a mention this week.
Definitely. Now, more incredibly sad news arrived this past week with the announcement that two-time Tour de France winner Laurent Fignon had lost his battle against cancer. The Frenchman was only 50 years old.
You were away at Eurobike when this happened.
I actually heard that you were on the phone, and I was literally about to go through the front door of the hall when I heard that he'd passed away, and I was absolutely gutted. I couldn't believe it.
Well, I mean, I tweeted at the time, you know, the wind was taking out my, actually had tears in my eyes running down my cheeks, because, you know, I was a huge Le Mans fan, and, you know, Fignon was the devil incarnate, really, because he was Le Mans' major challenger. But as I've aged and become less black and white, although some people might argue about that one, I've come to appreciate what a great champion he was. I've really enjoyed watching him and listening in my crap way when I've been on holiday in France to his punditry on French telly. Looking back, I mean, I've spent the last week looking at shots of YouTube of him on Le Plan. There's a lot of old footage of him. Just a great, great champion. A man of dignity, and a man who fought his final battle with cancer with the same aggression and passion that he raced. And the tributes have been gushing from every direction. I mean, he was your great hero, so I mean, you must have been gutted.
Oh, I certainly was. I mean, kind of the exact opposite of yourself. I was a Fignon fan rather than a Le Mans fan. Although, like yourself, you know, Le Mans has shot up in my expectations over the years. But yeah, I mean, I was struck by, you know, the comment that he made when we reported on this back in July, when it was announced that he was going to be commentating on French television, and he said, "I don't want to die at 50. All I know is my cancer isn't evolving, and I'm still fighting." And I was struck by the fact that, as I say, he was commentating on French television only a few months ago, so he must have gone downhill really, really quickly.
Yeah, and I mean, chapeau to David Harmon and Sean Kelly, because they did a beautiful tribute before the start of the Vuelta coverage, and the day after he died, Kelly was almost in shock, clearly on the telly, and Harmon was having real difficulty remembering riders' names, which shows how caught he was, because, you know, if there's one thing that man is, it's a bloody encyclopedia. So he'll be missed by everybody. I mean, twice won the Tour de France. There's a great quote where somebody stopped him in the street and said, "Aren't you the man who lost the Tour de France by 8 seconds in 1989? He said, "No, I'm the man who won it twice."
Yeah, quite. Speaking of tributes, Robert Miller, who made his Tour de France debut in the same year as Fignon, gave a moving tribute to the Frenchman over at Cycling News, saying that, "I was shocked when it was announced he was ill, and I resented that he was suffering so much until he passed away. After giving so much of himself, he deserved better. He was intelligent, humorous, and truly a special athlete and a person. He will be missed. Others called him difficult and moody, but I liked that aspect of his character, and I liked that he didn't tolerate fools and shoddy media people either. I liked the fact that he used to hide behind the Credit Lyonnais stand in the Tour Village so he could grab 5 minutes of peace and quiet to read his newspaper without interruptions."
Yeah, I mean, and Miller coming out of hiding to make comments just shows how much Fignon meant to him.
Now, moving on, Bradley Wiggins brought home an impressive, although not entirely unsurprising, Team Sky 1-2-3 in the British Time Trial Championships, with Chris Froome and Geraint Thomas completing the team's dominance in Wales.
It's no fair, really. You know, these boys are our poor local boys. What chance do they stand? They're just like big bullies coming over from the continent.
It is a bit like Man United showing up to play, you know, Govan Brownies. It's just not right.
I tell you what, though, Michael Hutchinson, he's been dominant in British time trial and pretty much since I was racing, which is a long, long time ago, let's be blunt. managed to get within 2 minutes of Wiggins and was within 30 seconds of Geraint Thomas, and was, you know, 2.5 minutes in front of Matt Bottrell, who was in fifth. So Hutchison deserves a big well done for that ride. But, you know, with the miles these guys have got in their legs, with the effort that's put into their aerodynamic position, you know, there was no way the local guys were going to get close. But, you know, 52.7 kilometres, rolling course, and he does it in 105. That's fast.
Yeah, Chris Froome was 1 minute 22 slower, with Geraint Thomas coming in at 1:35 down.
And, you know, just as the men who've been racing in the continent all year have come over and bullied and kicked in our poor little domestic riders, same's happened with the women. Emma Pooley, unsurprisingly, spanked it in the women's title, and was... She was only 19 seconds ahead of Julia Shaw and 27 seconds over Wendy Hufenagel, but... what a season Pooley's having. So, you know, good ride for the women as well.
I think Freud would probably have a field day with the sentence that you let slip a second ago there, where Emma Pooley and the word spank were placed in close proximity. I shall say nothing more than that.
What can I say? I'm an open book.
Sticking with Team Sky and the forthcoming Tour of Britain, it has been announced that the team will start in Rochdale this Saturday in new black and green kit as the bid to save 1 billion trees in the Amazon rainforest throughout the race.
Just by changing their kit?
Apparently so. It's bizarre, you know. Who'd have thought that just changing a cycling kit would save some trees?
I tell you, cycling needs to get behind being green. We do lots of urban stuff about saving the planet and that sort of thing. But pro cycling, it must burn a fair bit of carbon, mustn't it?
I wouldn't say quite as much as Formula One. But,
not quite.
Apparently this is taking advantage of a UCI rule that allows teams to compete in one race with different kit. The British squad has replaced the blue stripes on its kit for green, calling it the Sky Rain Forest Rescue Kit.
I'd actually wear that.
Do you like it?
The thing about Team Sky, we go on about their toothpaste and their colour stripe pillows and all that kind of crap, right? The big thing is they actually follow through with what they say they're going to do. You know, they've really followed through with the grassroots.
Apart from winning the tour.
Shut up. let's just brush that under the carpet, okay? Stuff like, you know, the supporting grassroots cycling in Britain, the Sky Rides, all that kind of stuff, they've actually followed through, put up the money, and, you know, they're doing the job. So when they get this, I've got a feeling they might actually put some money towards, you know, the rainforest. So if you can support it by buying the jersey, your money might actually go where it's supposed to go.
Well, according to Sky's press release, the 6 riders will have new helmets, water bottles, saddles and bikes for the 8-stage event. And Sky's Rainforest Rescue Initiative aims to raise £4 million to save 1 billion trees in the Amazon. All the money raised is donated to the World Wildlife Fund. Jonathan Vauters has been talking about the demise of the Cervelo test team, which has allowed his Garmin Transition squad to take on half a dozen of Cervelo's best riders, including Paris-Roubaix runner-up Hushov, and also have Cervelo as the new bike sponsor for 2011.
I feel a bit sorry for the poor Garmin boys who are getting a kick out so that these the Cervelo boys can come in.
Well, I mean, I don't think that's going to be the case. I think Vauters said that he was trying to help find positions for as many of the Cervelo staff as he can, although he did say that all the current Garmin Transition staff will stay, including head director sportif Matt White.
I think the staff are, but some of the riders are being given the heave-ho, apparently.
Yeah, that's true. That is true. Sorry, yeah. I think the UCI allows a maximum of 30 riders, but Garmin only had 28 this year. So with 6 incoming, he's got some difficult decisions to make.
I feel sorry for anybody trying to ride against the squad in the classics. You've got Hushovd, Häusler... You know, and I mean, Garmin were already strong in the classics, and you've added Roger Hammond, Brett Lancaster, Dan Lloyd, Andreas Clear. You know, spring classics are going to be a treat to watch, and these Cervelo bikes are going to be ridden very, very fast by some very determined people.
I mean, Vauters himself said that, you know, we still got to watch out for Fabian Cancellara and Tom Boonen, but as you say, it's an incredibly strong looking classics team for next year.
Well, they're going to start the year as number one.
I believe so. I think it's to do with this bizarre UCI points scoring system where points scored by riders at Cervelo actually carry on or carry over to Garmin. So they may well start as a number one team for next season.
Which is astonishing. I mean, I remember watching the genesis of this team with Miller and Vochters, and they talked about it being a long-term project. And here they are, number one, you know, a scant number of years after that. So that's a hell of a job they've done.
Yeah, so it's only 5 years since they started. Of course, the question that emerges from the dissolution of the Cervelo team and its absorption into Garmin is what happened to existing bike sponsor Felt. The American manufacturer released a press statement saying that it had chosen not to exercise its option to continue.
There's a surprise, eh? It's a shame. I mean, Felt have done a lot to support Garmin. I think they deserved to stay on, but I think part of the deal was almost certainly that the Cervelo was the bike they rode, and Felt will pop up somewhere else. You know, they're a major brand now, so they'll find another big team to sponsor.
Well, it certainly does look like that's what they want to do. In a press statement, they said, Felt remains committed to the sport of bicycle racing and the ideal that accompanies professional cycling. Rest assured, we will continue to support elite teams and athletes in the future. So it's very much a case, I think, of them looking for the next team to get into bed with there.
Yeah, and I mean, the other interesting thing is we've banged on about women's cycling pretty much since the Velocast started. And another part of the transplant is that the women's team goes across as well, which Vochters has openly admitted he knows hee-haw about. You know, he's got no idea about.
Did he actually use the phrase hee-haw? Because I'd be really impressed if he did.
I think he might have said absolutely no experience, but you know, you get the gist. But I mean, they're going to have to back that up because Gerard Ruman, one of the Cervelo founders, is really passionate about women's racing. And with the way Vochters has grown Garmin in 5 years, it'll be interesting to see if he can get his teeth into it and, you know, give it the profile it deserves.
Now to Canada, where the first annual The Ride for Red is due to commence on the 26th of September. The event is a 4,000-kilometre bike ride from Calgary to Santa Monica, California and Los Angeles, and is in support of both the Canadian Red Cross and American Red Cross, with a fundraising goal of $1 million.
And actually is the only reason I'm following Miss Canada on Twitter.
The only reason.
I'm not stalking her in any way whatsoever.
Remember, John, it's me and the Velocast listeners you're talking to here, not Ailsa.
Tell you what I really like, actually. And I mean, this is about Miss Canada. It's not about the Ride for Red. She's just a proper good-looking woman. You know, she's not the kind of pimped-up prom queen thingy. Anyway, that's neither here nor there.
We should explain, actually, that there'll be 3 full-time riders in this and 10 celebrity riders and various day riders that will participate in the race. And one of those, of course, is Miss Canada. You just didn't...
Not that I'm fixated on it. Is anybody else riding?
Well, the only one that popped out for me, if you'll excuse the obvious double entendre in that, was Miss Canada. But that's, I think, speaks more to my lack of knowledge on Canadian celebrities.
I actually didn't look any further. You know,
that doesn't surprise me in the slightest.
Katie Lang and Leonard Cohen, and that's me for Canadian. Oh, and what's his name? Neil Young, him as well. Actually, the reason I wanted to
bring this up... We're going to get hate mail from Canada now, you know.
If
South Park wasn't bad enough, now the Canadians
join the queue, mate. Join the queue. Actually, I brought this up for a very serious reason, and it's to do with the Armageddon thing, and I don't really think it's Armageddon, so, you know, don't worry too much, people. Is that it's in support of the Canadian Red Cross and the American Red Cross. And if there's one thing this year's hammered home, it's that people around the world need help to be available when they can't help themselves. Have a look at this. Give your support. Even if all you do is donate to one of the Red Cross societies. It's a nice site. It's a suitably long ride down a decent course. But more than that, it's money for causes that will help people around the world. So get stuck in with your credit card.
Yes, before John makes any further attempts to extract tears from glass eyes, you can find out more at theRideForRed.com. Now, according to the Pennsylvania news website PennLive.com, a 23-year-old Lebanon man was arrested on drugs charges on Friday evening after police said he was riding a bicycle while drinking a bottle of beer, holding 2 cell phones and intending to sell cocaine and Xanax. I mean, should he be a man and not an octopus?
Americans are mental, aren't they? I mean, seriously. What will they be doing next? Burning religious texts in the hope it will make a difference? Anyway.
Yes, let's move on from that.
Moving swiftly on. This guy's got immense talent, 2 cell phones, a bottle of beer, and cocaine on a bicycle. We've gone on and on about how you can carry anything on a bicycle and, you know, they're great for promoting commerce. This just sums it up. I mean, it's a funny story, which is why we put it in. But it's good to see even the criminal classes are recognising the utility of the bicycle in the workplace.
I would actually like to know which type of bike he was riding, because it would make a really, really cool marketing ploy for the next few months. You know, the new Kona, whatever, the choice for drug dealers, that kind of thing. Right.
Beer, coke and 2 phones. We can handle it. No, it's brilliant. It's a brilliant story. It really is.
Now, on now to proof that John Galloway is not the hard-bitten roadie that he has purported to be on this show for the past 18 months. He's been lying to you, ladies and gentlemen, and the evidence I submit is his bookmarking of a site entitled Cycling for Softies.
It's funny. I mean, this company has lurked in my consciousness since pretty much since I started cycling, because it's been around since 1981, and I'd entirely forgotten about it until it was brought to my attention by Michael Shires, our favourite hedge fund manager. And you and I are both Francophiles. We both love wandering through France, you know, and trying to get a wee bit off the beaten track and that sort of thing, eating good French food. And, you know, we're both cyclists. And one of the big things I've found, particularly since we had children, is it's really hard to enjoy, you know, cycling in France, because you feel you're taking a day away from the family. You know, if you say I'm off on my bike, they're stuck somewhere without you, which is a terrible hardship. And
someone consider it a bonus, but let's not get into that.
Well, it's a hardship for my family because my wife doesn't drive, so if I'm away on their bike, you know, they're stuck. They can't go anywhere. But since 1981, Susie's been organising these holidays where, essentially, she books a hotel every night. And there's a variety of things you can do, but she books a hotel every night, makes sure you've got a 4-course gourmet dinner, gives you the equipment you need, and you ride 25 miles a day from hotel to hotel, carrying minimal baggage, all your stuff's handled. But most importantly, once you've had the initial guiding, you're on your own, so you don't feel you're part of a scout outing. And, you know, she's won awards from, she won the Vive Clicquot Business Award, she's been in BBC Holiday, which I think maybe where I first saw her, all sorts of awards. And I'm actually going to try and set up an interview with her, because the amazing thing about this is I showed this to Ailsa, and you know what Ailsa's like about a bicycle. I mean, my wife hates bikes. She just hates them. And I showed her this, and she said, oh, we could do that next year. So if you're a keen cyclist with another half who isn't, or you've got small kids, because they either cater for small kids, this is kind of like a week-long or a long weekend-long version of the tours around Paris we talked about a couple of weeks ago, where it's a cycling activity, but you can get your family involved because it's not particularly hardcore. So, in this day and age, to have a business since 1981 that's still running 30 years later, I thought it deserved a mention.
It certainly does, and you can find out lots more at cycling-for-softies.co.uk. Now, I have a note here that just mentions hardcourt bicycle polo. I know nothing more than that.
Actually,
you sneak these things in at the last minute, and I have no idea.
Snuck that in with literally 2 minutes to go because I'd forgotten about it. And it's actually a favour for our friend Jimmy at fuckgas.org, which has been one of my favourite sites for as long as I can remember. And Louisville's hosting its first hardcore bike polo tournament. Now, not hardcore, that sounds dirty. Hardcourt bike polo tournament.
I was interested up until you changed that there. I thought this might sound like something interesting.
Oh, knowing Jimmy, it's entirely possible. But I'll just let that hang for a moment. Hardcore bicycle polo. How mental is that? So it's on the 16th of October at noon in Shelby Park. And it's in conjunction with Bicycling for Louisville, who are having a party to celebrate. I think it's their new chief, but Jimmy calls it their HMFIC, which is Head Something or Other in Charge. So if you like bicycle polo and you want to have a party, and I've seen the pictures, these guys party hard, be at Shelby Park on October the 16th in Louisville.
Before we go on to talk about Eurobike proper, I had the pleasure of interviewing the legendary Joe Murray. I'm here with, I think it's fair to say, mountain biking legend, Joe Murray. I wanted to ask you started off as a road cyclist. Can you you know, with a local club, you know, can I ask you what attracted you to what was going on off-road at that point?
Well, I lived in Marin County, which some people think is one of the birthplaces, you know, one of them. So it was all around me. And at the time, I guess I had a one-speed cruiser bike. And so that was kind of the bike to have, and even that was considered, you know, like a, I guess you could call it a paperboy bike or a Schwinn type of bike. And so it kind of just came from there, really.
Sure.
And also that was even before, that was like people were just starting to put gears on those kind of bikes too, so.
So were you kind of aware of there being a kind of local scene, that there was something different going on there?
Yeah, definitely a local scene. I mean, I always think I was in the right place at the right time. It was, you know, space.
One of those things. Kind of moving forward a bit to, you know, 1983, you kind of started off as being, you know, relative unknown to really 18 months later to 85, where there's that incredible 12 victory run. Do you think anyone will ever be able to match that?
Well, I don't know if it's been done yet or not, actually.
No.
Okay. Well, you know, to put it in perspective, I mean, the sport was totally different back then. It was a much smaller scene. I mean, there was definitely some fast guys, but, you know, really, when it became international, the Europeans got into it, that's when it got so competitive and more professional. So I can see that being, you know, it's like a different sport. So it's kind of hard to say, well, will it ever be matched? You know, well, if it will be, then that would be pretty incredible, because it's just so much more competitive and it's, you know, all that stuff.
Yeah, of course. I mean, you've worked with some really incredible companies, you know, from Voodoo to Daho and, you know, Test Rider for Shimano, etc. What attracts you to companies like that?
I would say the work itself. I mean, I think any competitor realizes, you know, it's a temporary career, and so I always thought, well, you know, I'm not just a racer. I'm also kind of a nuts and bolts guy, and I've worked in bike shops as a mechanic, and so always wanted to be in the industry. And then at that point, I've always wanted to work for companies I like, you know, especially the people that run them. You know, there's a lot of reasons, but you know, DeHaan, for instance, Josh, the owner, he's just, you can tell when you talk to him, he's just into it. I mean, it has nothing to do with what's selling or, you know, the bottom line or anything. It's like he's got this new biologic stuff. It's all touring, like iPod holders and batteries and dyno hubs. And it's just cool because, you know, there's no sure thing there, you know, but he's just into it. So that's one reason.
Sure. I was going to ask you as well, at a time when everyone was going with a kind of standard road-based top tube, you were the one that kind of came up with that, what is now industry standard slope. And there was also the Project 2 fork, which people are still raving about today. You know, do you feel that there was, you know, what made you come up with these kind of ideas?
Well, I'd like to, you know, give credit where credit's due, because the sloping top tube, actually, I would say Paul Brody, he was a hand-built bike builder in Vancouver, BC. And when I started working for Kona, it was before it was Kona, they sold Brody bikes. And he was building sloping top tube bikes. And, you know, nobody ever did it, you know, on a production level. I mean, there was another company in the UK actually called Overburys, I think.
All right, yeah.
Yeah, and they did a sloping top tube bike, right, too. And it's, you know, I'm sure there was some other builders out there doing it, but I guess we were the first production mainstream bike company to do that. And obviously you can see what's happened from there. So.
Sure. And is there one particular product that you've been associated with that you're most proud of?
Not really.
I suppose it's kind of like choosing between your children, really, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Jeez. Yeah, that's a tough question. You know, I believe that everybody borrows ideas from everybody else, and really what it comes down to is just having the vision to go with something. and take what you see and be really observant. So I can't really think of any one thing. You know, I've always like kind of looked at details and you know, at this point, I don't know. I mean, we have a new bike. It's a new full suspension bike. Perhaps, you know, that's, you know, the most difficult thing I've done, you know, dealing with suspension geometry and all that kind of stuff.
Sure. So. Is there ever anything you've ever seen out there just from any other company you think, oh, I wish I had a thought of that. I wish I had a nailed that one.
Oh, geez. You know, like a shock fork, perhaps. I don't know. That's another good one. Yeah, I think about that all the time. But again, I can't think of any one thing. There's so many things. I mean, yeah. Sorry, I can't.
No problem. Yeah. I know. I appreciate it. It was a tough question to just throw at you there. What's your favorite bike to ride at the minute?
Actually, to be honest, I mean, there's a lot of bikes. I do ride a lot of bikes, unfortunately, with my work with Shimano. They send me bikes to ride, and I also try to get my hands on as many bikes to actually own or just to test ride. And my favorite bike right now is a Giant Trans X. And the way I look at that bike is it's not like a boutique bike. You can go and buy it anywhere as complete, and the suspension is as good as anything. So I look at that and I'm thinking this. I actually just like the bike for what it is, regardless of the price or anything.
Sure. We're here at Eurobike, and I appreciate you're very, very busy at your own stand. But have you had a chance to kind of look around? Is there anything that's caught your eye?
I have actually, and I've been getting a kind of a head scratcher from people when I mention it. But I've been looking and taking as many. Electric assist full suspension mountain bikes.
I saw that as well. Yeah.
And there's, and I've probably got pictures of about close to 20 of them now. I mean, like a real mountain bike with 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 inches of travel. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people think, oh, this is a motorcycle. It's not a real bike, but I have a feeling this is a segment that could really take off. You know, and sure, there's some things to be said about having a motor on your bike, but at the same time, I think nobody's putting a gasoline motor. It's electric. You can recharge them and power them ecologically. So,
One other thing that kind of struck me before I came here today was, could we ever see you do Leadville 100?
You know, I have a lot of friends who do it. I actually have a couple friends who've done it every year since they put it on. I think it's over 10 years now. And I've never really had a desire to do it because it's mostly dirt road. And it's also gotten to be quite a internet, like a, you know, there's been, you know, Lance Armstrong's done it and, you know, and all this stuff. So I don't know. I tend to like, if I do race, I like to do under the radar kind of events, and maybe events that have just started. Like last year I went and did a 3-day stage race in Guatemala.
Sure.
And it was really awesome because the promoters are just two guys, local guys, who are mountain bikers, and they wanted to put on this race. And this is the third year when I did it that they had put on the race, and they did an awesome job, like some of the best organizing, and just they took care of everything, the lodging, the food. And the courses were really great. And so that's the kind of events I like to do. I mean, maybe Leadville would have been something back in the early days, you know, so.
Yeah. You kind of, when I did my introduction there, said that I'm with, you know, mountain biking legend, you kind of blushed slightly. How do you feel about being described as a legend?
Oh, that's fine. I mean, I mentioned before, I was in the right place at the right time. And, you know, obviously you have to have something to make something happen. Not anybody can do it. But I for some reason, I've just had this modest... I always try to be modest about things. I just don't like to, self-promote or, you know, I don't like to have any pretensions, you know, about myself. Or, you know, so... I don't know if it's some kind of just thing about my personality or what, but I've just always been that way. So,
actually, you know, anybody that follows us on Twitter will know that I missed Eurobike, Grr. One of the things that really gutted me was that you had the pleasure of talking to Joey. He's been a a design hero of mine for a long time. I mean, top class racer, as you've just heard. But essentially, a lot of the shape of the modern hardtail is solely down to Joe Murray. So I'm jealous. You're a lucky bugger.
And such a night. I mean, I tweeted this, you know, seconds after I came away from talking to him. Possibly the nicest man in the world. I've never, with a man that has done as much as he has in his career, both in terms of racing and design, to be so humble and so self-effacing was really inspiring. What just, I can't get over enough what a nice bloke he was.
Thing is, when you know you're the best, it's easy to be humble. It's only when you're worried that you're not that you get stroked.
No, I actually felt this was genuine. It was just the nature of the man. But anyway, let's move swiftly on to Eurobike. And wow, what a show. What a show.
Aye, carry on. I'll just go away and make a cup of tea. I'll be back in 10 minutes.
No, you should be interviewing me here. As John alluded to a minute ago, he unfortunately couldn't be at Eurobike this year, so it was left to Muggins here to trek
struggle through.
Well, my feet, I don't think, have forgiven me yet. I'm still dealing with the blisters from walking several hundred miles a day trying to get round all the stands. And I mean, that's a point to be made. The show actually felt bigger again this year, as hard as that would be to believe.
Well, last year I wore a pedometer the first day. And the first day in wandering around last year, just in the halls, you know, nothing else, just in the halls, I covered 15 miles.
Oh, I can well believe it. I think one of the biggest areas for discussion at Eurobike this year was, of course, e-bikes. I mean, last year they were certainly the preserve of, you know, the beardy weirdies and were ostracised over in the Zeppelin Hall. This year they were just everywhere. Just about every major manufacturer had some manner of e-bike offering, with, I think, the notable exception of Specialized, who we mentioned in a show, you know, some months ago.
Aye, they have to keep theirs under wraps for the classics.
That's what it is. I mean, I had an interesting discussion with my travelling companion, James, on how I think we both think that the e-bikes need to develop a kind of visual language that differentiates them from, I use the bunny ears parenthesis here, normal bikes. And I think in exactly the same way that road bikes are now completely different from mountain bikes.
I think that's starting to happen.
That is true. I mean, last year it was very much, you know, let's take a Dutch city bike and strap a battery to the rear rack. And it's not to say that it's still not going on, but there at least are people trying.
Yeah, I mean, and we're going to talk about a few in a minute. And with one exception, which I think is actually for a purpose, they have all got a visual identity, which is different from a normal bike. So your expectations are slightly shifted. You know, you don't judge them by the same aesthetic standards, which is what, you know, Matthew at Specialized was talking about when we were talking last week.
Well, let's get to a couple then that kind of leapt out. The first one was the Django Flick. And Django released this, I think, last year at Eurobike, just in its normal version, but they've now got an e-bike version of it as well. And the reason I wanted to talk about this is, of course, the Django Flick is a folding bike. So you've got this tiny little bike that folds away to nothing in seconds, but it's an e-bike as well. And I thought this would be absolutely fantastic if you're the type of person that needs to, you know, get a train, for example. You can just put it in the corner of the train or on the bus or whatever, and then when you get to your destination, you're free to kind of cycle around mountainous cities.
Yeah, I had a good play with the Django last year when it wasn't an e-bike. And if it's the same frame, what I thought was really cool about it is it's a two-stage fold.
That's right, yeah.
So you can fold it down, so essentially it becomes its own trolley, so you can wheel it about comfortably. And then when you have to get in the train and put it in the corner, it folds down in an even smaller package. Add a battery and a motor. You're right, you know, it's a perfect mixed transport commuting.
Yeah,
bike. Brilliant.
And it assists up to three speeds. I think it was 10, 15 and 25 k an hour. And of course, those are selectable from the handlebars. I had to laugh, though, because there was a girl on the Ergon Topeak stand, because this, of course, comes from Topeak, demonstrating how easily it folded in a kind of very elaborate The Price is Right fashion, you know, all hand waves and wrist flicks.
Oh, stop being British. That's the Continentals making a meal of it, that is.
I mean, no details on price yet, but I'd imagine details will be released on djangobikes.com. On now to the Cube EPO e-bike. Yes, they really did call it the EPO.
No, it's a brilliant name. Absolutely brilliant name. And if you... This is what we're talking about. If you slightly suspend your the aesthetic sense you've developed through watching bicycles, you know, for the last 120 years or whatever, this still looks like a bike, but it's slightly different. And what they've done is they've integrated the battery, I think, into the seat post.
Yeah.
The good thing about this is every cable and wire on the thing is concealed, so it doesn't look like a Heath Robinson welded together in a garage. It looks like quite a stylish urban bike. So it's that movement we're talking about to them being pretty as well as functional.
Yeah, I mean, when we say it's pretty, I mean, it's a nice looking bike in a kind of space age futuristic type way. I mean, there's nothing traditional looking here, but I really like this. As you say, John, there was nothing Heath Robinson about it. It's been all been thought out properly. I mean, they're even quoting that it uses multi-layer paint, which also helps save weight. So, I mean, people are at least thinking along the lines of, well, we appreciate in order to make an e-bike, you need to put a battery in it, which adds weight, of course, to the thing. So let's look at how we can reduce weight from the bike frame itself to compensate for the fact that we need a battery. I was really impressed with Cube's e-bike.
Yeah, I mean, if you imagine a time trial bike that's had a hybrid glued onto the front, that's what it looks like. In essence, you know, it's the seat tube of a time trial bike, and it's that long flattened shape so they can fit the battery in. And I think the biggest step forward is that concealed battery, you know, because then it doesn't look like an e-bike. And we've all grown accustomed to, you know, to wide profile tubes. So it's not the shock on the eye that it would have been 20 years ago.
Yeah, of course.
You know, it's a step forward. I like this a lot.
Yeah. Well, sticking with kind of space-age design cues, Cannondale and Bosch have worked together to create, and I think we spoke about this again a few months ago when it was first announced, they've worked together to create an e-bike concept, and similar to the Cube one, the battery fits in the seat tube there too.
Cannondale, recently, before they got stuck in with Bosch, I think, exhibited something similar with Toshiba. But the Bosch thing's really serious. You know, it's a big company that have got very serious about e-bikes. And Cannondale, Carton Reed actually showed some really good footage and demo day of this, where they showed the battery, once again, is in the seat tube in the same way as the Cube one is. And you can either charge it in place or out of, you know, take it out to charge it if, you know, if the bike's locked in a garage and your plug point's in the house.
Yeah, the guy from Cannondale actually demonstrated how easy it is. You just lift, there's a kind of latch, and you take the saddle off and you've got access to the battery straight away. And I mean, it was a really quick, easy mechanism. It wasn't, you know, take Allen key A and insert into, you know, socket Z, etc., etc.
So, I mean, this is clearly a prototype. I mean, compared to the Cube, it actually looks a bit unfinished to me, which is weird for Cannondale. But I could see myself having a lot of fun in a hilly city on this, you know, because with those tyres and that standover height and the lefty fork, you'd be taking the road less travelled, wouldn't you?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, you'd be choosing that I'll just go down these stairs and up that back alley.
Exactly.
So, it looks good as well. Things are moving fast. Next year, we're going to see completely different things again. It'll have moved on once more.
Yeah. I mean, it's nice. I mean, I don't think it's as nice looking as the Cube one, and I see what you're saying about, you know, with the lefty fork, so on and so forth. The interesting bit for me here was the aspect where it's in partnership with Bosch, who I think are really trying to position themselves as the de facto manufacturers of drives for e-bikes.
Oh no, that's huge. I mean, that's one of the biggest things. It's once you get people like Bosch involved, it's not people playing in their garage. You know, it's big companies doing things seriously, and we're going to see products that will hit the masses.
Mm. I mean, it should also be noted that, you know, it wasn't just the concept here, and Cannondale have actually made some moves into more traditional-looking e-bikes, if that's not a contradiction in terms. And these were nice too, and didn't fall too heavily into that, oh, it's just a bike plus a battery theme. But there was some nice offerings there from Cannondale, aside from the kind of futuristic-looking concept that they had.
Yeah, I mean, they've always been at the forefront. I loved Cannondale. I mean, I worked in a very large Cannondale dealer for quite a long time.
Yeah, well, moving now from the potentially sublime to the possibly ridiculous, Australian manufacturer KTM also showed off the e-race and e-cross sport and trekking machines. Now, essentially what this adds up to is it's a mountain bike with a battery.
See, we came to opposite decisions about this, because I don't think you like it very much.
I just can't get my head around it. I mean, I know Joe Murray briefly mentioned it as one of his favourite things at Eurobike this year during the interview. I just can't get... I mean, I can totally see, understand and accept why e-bikes have to exist. I just can't get my head round why you would want one on a mountain bike. But I mean, I'm more than happy to be proven wrong on this.
See, I've got two words.
Go on.
Police and paramedics.
But is it really? It's an urban bike then. It's not. It's not a mountain bike, and this seems to me more like a true sport mountain bike.
Oh no, it is. But when you look at, we looked at the paramedics in Sheffield and that sort of thing, and the police in London, and all they're riding are mountain bikes. And the theory with that, or behind that, is if somebody takes off across a park, and you're on an urban bike, you're going to end up on your arse. Whereas if you're on a true mountain bike, you can essentially go anywhere that someone on foot can go. So I think, I mean, I could be wrong, but I think this is aimed firmly at the, you know, at the forces market, because KTM, they make fantastic motorbikes and they're already in use in some continental forces. I agree that it's possibly the ugliest e-bike I've ever seen, but I think you'll see a lot of them with big green paramedic defibrillators on the back.
I mean, see, if they'd pitched it like that with some manner of, you know, police or paramedic insignia on it, I would have looked at it and gone, I know exactly where that's headed. It's the fact it was dressed up and sitting alongside the other mountain bikes that KTM, I mean, they've got a massive stand, but sitting alongside all the other mountain bikes that KTM had to offer, it just, I couldn't, because where they seem to be visually positioning it is as an alternative to riding up Glen Tress or whatever trail.
And I was up Glen Tress a few weeks ago. I could quite happily use one of these.
I don't think that's the point. Anyway, these retail for €2,400 and €2,200 for the race and cross, respectively. And if you want one, I'm sure KTM would be happy to sell you one. Now, nominated for a Eurobike Award was the prototype of the Urban Arrow from graduate designer, now I'm struggling to pronounce this, Wites van Mansum, who had been asked to design an updated back Fiets.
I think this is my favourite back Fiets we've seen since we started the show. Because, again, I showed this to Ilsa, who's my arbiter of all things when you need someone who isn't actually a nutter about cycling. And she said, that would be really good for around Peebles. Because it's one of those things where you could genuinely replace a second car with this. Really clean lines. The front hopper is incredibly versatile. You know, you could use it for carrying kids, carrying huge loads. And they've come come out quite into the open and said they want you to be able to carry 180 kilograms of cargo without sweating, because not everybody has the legs of a pro cyclist. This is brilliant. I mean, it's just brilliant.
I really can't disagree with any of that. I when I saw it, I actually didn't think e-bike.
No, I mean, the motor's completely invisible. It's mid-engined, I think. It's hidden underneath the back of the front hopper,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, and I just thought it was a cargo bike, you know, in the same way that the Mobi from Velorbis is, or any number of others. And when I actually discovered it was an e-bike, I thought that's utter genius and completely removes that barrier to a bike like this, i.e. it'll weigh a ton. Yeah. And it's going to struggle getting up any manner of hill unless you've got thighs like Fabian Cancellara. Absolutely brilliant thing.
Yeah. And I mean, what they've done is they've combined it with proper gearing, so that if you want to ride up a hill in a low gear with the engine helping you, there's virtually no effort at all. So yeah, it could genuinely make a difference in places where the bicycle's already been accepted as a beast of burden, you know. And I'm thinking Holland, I'm thinking Denmark, I'm thinking that kind of place. But it's actually quite beautiful as well. I like this a lot.
Also taking an award at Eurobike this year was the PC2 pedal from Ergon.
I'm quite happy to say Ergon are my favourite contact point manufacturer ever in the history of cycling. And I will try, without reservation, anything they make, because everything that they make has made a difference to my enjoyment on the bike. So I'm slightly biased. But again, flat pedals. For a normal urban bike, you see all sorts of people pedalling with, you know, the pedal under the ball of their foot, or a lot of people pedalling it with under the arch. And what Ergon have done is looked at the requirements for a flat urban pedal, ignored all the kind of history that comes before, started from scratch, and designed something that's going to be in my town bike. You know, it just is.
I mean, I've heard from sources on the inside that Ergon have spent tens of thousands in development for this pedal alone.
The thing that gets me is really narrow Q factor. So unlike many urban bikes where the pedals sit, you know, so far out you feel like you're John Wayne riding a horse. Yeah. The reflectors, instead of being an afterthought, were developed with Busch and Müller, who are one of our favourite lighting companies. The composite body was developed in partnership with Magura. You know, the list goes on and on. They've looked at every detail of this. There's a stop on the inside, which unobtrusively makes sure your foot's in the right position. 6-degree angle, so all your joints are aligned. I mean, the thing is just designed from the ground up to be the perfect flat pedal. It's a thing of beauty.
It is, and it's priced at $69.95, and you can find out more at ergon-bike.com. Quickly, before we move on to some picks of the week, I also noticed while on the Ergon stand that Ergon themselves have introduced another brand to the lineup called Form. Which essentially is going to be a kind of, I wouldn't say budget, but a medium range. So if you're kind of looking at the high quality Ergon grips, you've got this range of grips. As I say, it's a new brand called Form, which comes in at a lower price point, but it's still Ergon stuff.
That's going to be worth my, I mean, all I can say, the only thing I can say is every bike I have has an Ergon saddle on it. Every set of flat handlebars I have has Ergon grips in it. And that should, I mean, you know how picky I am about stuff. That should say something. I'm actually quite excited about putting these flat pedals in something. Because it's the contact points. They make more difference than almost anything after good fit to how comfy you are on a bike. And Ergon are completely dedicated to that.
Yeah, and as I say, that's precisely why I thought it was worthy to mention that they've got another brand coming out this year.
Yeah. No, absolutely.
Okay, right, time for some picks of the week.
Do you want to go first or shall I?
No, I'll go first, I don't mind. My pick of the week is actually based on a request from one of our listeners, Mr. Rob Reeves, who asked for a recommendation of a bike in the sub €1,000 category. So I had a good look round the several hundred hauls there seem to be at Eurobike this year, and of course there's literally tons of bikes from a huge number of manufacturers that would, I mean, all of them would make an ideal and great first road bike, but I really quickly came to the conclusion that the new Defy from Giant would be the one that I would go for.
Nah, can I argue with that? It's a gorgeous looking bike.
It really is. I mean, like most models in this kind of price range, it's aluminium frame, it's got a carbon fork, Shimano Sora will take care of your shifting for you, and you've got Tektro's R340 brakes. But the big draw for me was, as you say, John, how the bike looked. I mean, it's easy to get instantly drawn to all the new shiny, horny carbon stuff that costs several thousands of pounds, but this bike was so beautifully put together, you would have thought it was at least double the price. So kudos to Giant for making a bike that looks so good without, you know, resorting to you having to sell a kidney just to get it.
And let's put this in perspective. You know, out the box, properly set up by a bike mechanic, this thing will probably be lighter and ride better and shift better than the last bike I road raced on. You know, the developments in gear in the last 15 years have been astonishing. So this is a bike that's going to give you a huge amount of pleasure and a frame that's good enough that as the bits wear out, because that's what you're buying, you know, when you move up from entry-level stuff. The first leaps aren't really about improved performance when they're new. It's about, you know, better durability. So as bits wear out, you can replace them with better bits without it feeling out of place in a frame of this quality. So this Defy, I mean, it's a stunner for the price.
It really is. And the weld points on the frame were superb. I mean, when obviously they're having to get loads of these out of the factory and at a really low price. I think it's €799, something like that.
Yeah.
A casual glance, you would have thought it was a carbon frame. So good were the weld points on it.
Yeah, no, it's a lovely thing. I mean, it's a good pick of the week, and it just shows that although it's a lot of fun to spend $5,000 or $6,000 on something, you can actually get a lot of bike for not much money now.
For not much money at all. Right, now, your pick of the week.
My pick of the week's really quite a lot of bike for not much money.
Oh, that's a shock. Actually, that is a shock.
No, it really is. Inspired by your choice, I went for a bike which retails for just under $1,200 US, which is, what, under £1,000, certainly. Mm. And it's from Massey, Tim Jackson's forever promoting them in the spokesman. Yeah. And I'm really peed off, actually, because I quite fancied one of these, but as yet I can't find there's a UK importer. And it's the Massey Special CX, which is... It's a cyclocross bike, except, you know, as with most of these bikes, and like my beloved Co-Motion Norwester, what it actually is a bike that you can do almost anything on. Chuck on mudguards in a rack, perfect for commuting or light touring. Leave the cyclocross tyres on, perfect for some fire road or simple single track. Tiagra 9-speed, butted 4130 chrome alloy, Truvitive crankset with Tiagra and 105 mix. It's really gorgeous looking. It's that classic Massey panel tube where the logo is. There's a really nice colour called Root Beer. Comes with nice Tektro canties. For £1,200, I'm astonished you can buy a bike like this. And I wanted to put this beside the Defy to show that, you know, Giant can do it. Huge manufacturer, brilliant buying power. Massey aren't anywhere near as large, and for only slightly more, they can come in with one of the coolest looking bikes I've seen all year. So you don't have to spend a lot of money to have a lot of fun on a bike.
Definitely. Now, that's all we have time for this week. Thank you for listening and staying subscribed. You can contact us at our website, velocast.co.uk, or on Twitter, where we are at Velocast. Well, we hope you all have a great week, and hope to speak to you again soon for another edition of the Velocast.
Hi, I'm Joe Murray, and thanks for listening to the Velocast.